"You really are around the bend, aren't you, Holcomb?" he asked himself dryly. "Are you trying to tell me you're bored, and that being bored in the middle of a war is a bad thing?" He chuckled at the thought, trying to imagine how Delthak's company might respond to that particular proposition. Probably not very well. Still.
"What boat?"
The challenge from Fortune's deck watch plucked Barnes up out of his ruminations as Moffat responded.
"Delthak!"
he barked through a speaking trumpet, the ship's name warning the galleon that the approaching cutter had the ironclad's captain on board. There was a stir aboard the flagship as Moffat brought the cutter alongside and the bowman hooked neatly onto the main chains. The cutter's crew tossed oars in perfect unison, precisely timed, without a single command from Moffat, and Barnes smiled. No one looking at that meticulously drilled crew could possibly have guessed that they'd only come aboard Delthak barely a month earlier.
"Smartly done, Bradley," he said from the corner of his mouth, as he stood in the cutter looking up, gauging the boat's motion before he made his jump for the battens. Compared to other boat transfers he'd made during his career, this one wouldn't be particularly challenging despite the stiff breeze, since the cutter lay in Fortune's lee.
"Of course, the first time you take it for granted's going to be the time you fall into the water, the cutter smashes into you, you get driven under the turn of the bilge, and you drown on a perfectly calm day, with no excuse but your own stupidity," he reminded himself.
"Thank you, sir," Moffat replied equally quietly. "And mind that first jump."
Barnes gave him a moderate glare, which had no effect on the coxswain at all, and then jumped. As it happened, he timed it perfectly and climbed nimbly up the ship's tall side to the entry port without mishap. Bosun's pipes shrilled as he came aboard and the side party of Marines snapped to attention and presented arms. He touched his chest to return the salute, turned to salute the colors, and then turned back to find himself facing a towering, massively built captain with enormous shoulders. The man had to be as tall as Merlin Athrawis himself, and probably half again the Sajan's weight, and from where Barnes stood, none of it appeared to be fat. The giant held out a paw-like hand to clasp arms in greeting.
"Captain Gilbert Kiley," he rumbled in a strong Tarawisian accent. "Welcome aboard, Captain Barnes, and please accept my compliments for a job very well done last month."
"Thank you, sir," Barnes replied. There wasn't a lot else he could say.
"Admiral Whiteford asks you to join us in his day cabin."
"Of course, sir." Gavin Martin, the Baron of Whiteford, was dwarfed by his enormous flag captain, a small man with dark eyes and once dark hair, which had turned mostly silver. He had an alert, thoughtful air about him. He was also the man who'd commanded the Tarawisian squadron at the Battle of Armageddon Reef and been soundly defeated by then-Crown Prince Caleb in the first broadside engagement ever fought by galleons. It seemed like an eternity ago, yet less than 5 years had elapsed since that savage engagement, and Barnes wondered how it must seem to Whiteford and Cayley. Their navy and kingdom had been utterly defeated, and in the end, their king had been forced to accept Carisian sovereignty. Yet here Whiteford was, a Carisian admiral and Emperor Caleb Armok's port admiral in Baydard Bay. There had to be the odd moment when that rankled, despite the evidence of the high regard in which his one-time enemies held him. Still, Barnes suspected that the Earl of Thirsk, the other enemy commander off Armageddon Reef, might well have exchanged places with Whiteford if he'd had the chance. Besides, the captain's thought broke off as the man who'd been contemplating the panorama of the harbor through the galleon's stern windows turned to face him.
"Your Majesty," Barnes bowed quickly. "Forgive me, I didn't expect—"
"No reason you should have," Caleb Armok replied. "In fact, I've gone to some lengths to keep anyone from realizing I've come out to talk to you and the Admiral."
The Emperor smiled and waved at the tall, blue-eyed man standing quietly in one corner.
"I believe you've met Major Athrawes, Captain."
"Yes, Your Majesty."
Barnes held out his hand to the Sajin who'd conceived the mad audacity of the canal raid.
It's good to see you again, Sejin.
You should never be hasty about these things, Captain,
Athrawis replied.
I beg your pardon?
Barnes quirked an eyebrow.
Rushing to judgment about whether or not it's good to see me,
Athrawis said with a crooked smile.
I have it on fairly good authority that chaos, confusion, and mayhem follow me about.
I don't mind a little chaos and confusion as long as the mayhem gets visited on the right people, Sejin, Barnes told him, and the Emperor chuckled.
Well, you did a pretty fair job of visiting mayhem on our foes last month, Captain Barnes. And as they say, no good deed goes unpunished.
I've heard that, Your Majesty. Barnes regarded his Emperor with what he hoped was hidden trepidation, and Caleb smiled, then waved at the chairs around the polished table under the cabin skylight.
Since Admiral Whiteford's been so kind as to make his day cabin available to us, Captain Barnes, I think we should all be seated.
Of course, Your Majesty.
The only person in that cabin junior in rank to Halcom Barnes was Major Athrawis. However, there were majors, and then there were majors. And Barnes couldn't think of anyone Emperor Caleb was likely to consider senior to this particular major. He waited, watching the Sejin from the corner of one eye, while Caleb sat, followed by Whiteford, and then by Kaylee. Athrawis only smiled again, as crookedly as before, and took his place behind Caleb's chair. With the way cleared, Barnes went ahead and seated himself as a gray-haired, slightly built man appeared, carrying a silver tray laden with crystal decanters and glasses.
"Thank you, Zivas," Whiteford said, nodding towards the Emperor, and the valet set the tray on a side table and offered Caleb his choice of the decanters. The Emperor made his selection, and Zivas poured for him, then circled the table. Barnes was no judge of fine liqueurs, and he knew it, so there was no point pretending differently. He simply accepted whatever was poured and sipped politely, and almost blinked as golden glory with a smoky aftertaste rolled over his tongue and down his throat.
"Maybe I should learn to judge fine liqueurs," he told himself, savoring the sunburst explosion. "Not that I could afford this very often, I suspect."
"I ask you here because His Majesty has an idea that involves you, Captain Barnes," Whiteford said after a moment. "As I discovered once upon a time off the coast of Armageddon Reef, he frequently has ideas that end up making all sorts of difficulties for the ungodly." The small Taruisian smiled and raised his glass to the Emperor. "Now that I'm no longer counted among the ranks of the ungodly, except perhaps by Jaspar Clinton, that's just fine with me, you understand. However, I'd like to begin by asking for a report on the condition of your command."
Barnes stiffened ever so slightly, and Emperor Caleb shook his head.
"That's not an attempt to catch you out, Captain. The operation you and Captain Taylor carried out was bound to overstress your ships, especially when they're so new and we have so little experience operating them. We just need to know how well they stood up to the demands placed on them before we can know whether or not what we have in mind is workable."
"Of course, Your Majesty."
Barnes suppressed the need for another swallow of that marvelous elixir, set his glass on the table, and faced the Emperor squarely.
"To be honest, Your Majesty, the ships stood up far better than I ever expected, but they've still steamed nearly 20,000 miles. I never would have believed they could steam that far without a major breakdown, and I instructed Lieutenant Blandensberg, he's my engineer, Your Majesty, to carry out a complete engine inspection. He's torn them down to do that, and he's turned up some minor problems. The worst is the starboard engine's condenser, and that one does worry him a bit. Fortunately, the service galleon Sir Dustin and Captain Sagil sent along have all the spares he needs, and the mechanics aboard them are doing most of the work under his direction. Despite that, I'm afraid it's going to be some time, probably at least a couple of 5 days, before I could honestly report her ready for sea."
"Any problems outside Lieutenant Blundensberg's department?"
"Not any significant ones, Your Majesty. We have a few broken armor bolts, the bridge wings had to be rebuilt, it was necessary to replace several of the ventilator intakes, and one of the gun deck blowers broke a fan blade. All of that's already been dealt with, however."
"And Hador?"
"I believe Captain Taylor's repairs are going as well as my own, Your Majesty, but I'd hesitate to speak for him,"
Barnes said. He met Caleb's gaze levelly, and the Emperor nodded. As you probably know, Captain Barnes, he said, Sagan and Telesberg are still operating out of Spinefish Bay, and one of the service galleons will be sailing for Salak in the next day or two. We don't know how much longer they'll be able to go on operating. Once Sing Wu's passage starts to freeze, it freezes quickly, and we can't afford to get one of the ironclads trapped in the ice. For now, though, they're still operating 50 or 60 miles up the Hildemos, and generally keeping the Army of God around Salak on edge. Barnes nodded, although if truth be told, he was a long way from guessing where this was headed. Did the Emperor intend to send Delthak and Hador up to relieve Sagan and Telesberg? I have something a bit different in mind for you and Captain Taylor, however, the Emperor said, as if he'd read Barnes's mind, and rumor suggested he might very well be able to do exactly that. You do, Your Majesty? The Captain asked when Caleb paused, and the Emperor nodded. I do indeed, Captain. Fortunately, all the pieces for the operation I have in mind won't be available for some 5 days yet, so you should have ample time to complete your repairs and maintenance. And I think you'll find it just a bit warmer than Spinefish Bay would be, too. Probably in more than one way. Chapter 8 Thesmar, the Southmarch Lands, Republic of Sidermark.
I've never seen so many people in one place, Kidrick Figuera said softly.
He and Earl Hanth stood on one of the quartet of 120-foot-tall wooden observation towers Captain Lewis Simpson, Hanth's senior engineer, had built at his orders. Figuera wouldn't have considered the project himself for a lot of reasons, including the fact that he wasn't a Marine and didn't have a Marine's instinctive understanding for how much farther someone could see from a masthead. The tower on which they stood at the moment, built using spare spars from Admiral Hywitt's galleons, was in the second line of entrenchments, just behind Redoubt No. 1 and the bastion known as Timon's Angle, on the 110-foot crest of Sullivan Hill, which extended the visual horizon still farther. With heavy telescopes bracketed firmly to the railing around the tower's square platform, lookouts could see almost 20 miles. 16 miles beyond their own positions. The second tower stood roughly in the middle of the position, behind the island Redoubt and 5 miles west of Thesmar. The third stood in Redoubt No. 4 on Mount Yareth, and the fourth stood in the center of the city itself. Equipped with heliographs and signal flags, men in those towers could report every move the enemy made, or call down indirect fire from the angle guns Admiral Hywitt had landed from HMS Holocaust, one of the bombardment ships. 14 of them were mounted in the forward redoubts and bastions, and another 10 were positioned in the city itself. Heavier and less mobile than the Imperial Carizian Army's version of the same weapon, the naval angles could fire almost a mile farther, which meant at least one section of them could engage any spot within 2 or even 3 miles of the outermost lines of entrenchments. It would have been even nicer if the 1st Independent Marine Brigade had possessed any infantry mortars to add to its weight of fire, but there was plenty, indeed almost a surfeit, of other artillery available. As he stood in the warm morning sunlight beside the Sidermarkian general, Hanth could see the quadruple line of entrenchments spread out about him like some celestial model maker's handiwork. The outermost line ran 60 miles, from Sullivan Hill, southwest of the city, to the thoroughly misnamed Mount Yareth to the northeast. The innermost, just outside the city itself, was barely 15 miles in length. Open to the east, where the ships of the Imperial Carizian Navy watched Thesmar's back, the position Figuera had fortified was just under 15 miles deep at its deepest point, and he'd been working on it for months. It was actually a bit over-large for 24,000 men to hold. If, of course, they'd had 24,000 men, which they didn't. Yet. The healers were guardedly optimistic about the total number of Clifton Summers' men who'd be fit for duty over the next few 5 days, though, and Figuera had taken advantage of the Ceridon and the Yareth rivers when he planned his works.
To be sure, calling the Yareth a river was almost as ridiculous as calling the large hill of the same name a mount. It was more of a wide creek than a river, but its low-lying floodplain ran between Mount Yareth and Shadowline Mountain to the west. Shadowline really was a mountain, albeit a tiny one compared to the Glacier Hearts or Moonthorns, and the valley between it and Mount Yareth was marshy enough to have made throwing up the entrenchments across it difficult. Figuera had capitalized on that, excavating deep, wide moats in front of each earthwork barrier. The local water table was high enough to fill them quickly, and his fatigue parties had dammed the stream to create even wider inundations that stretched almost entirely across the valley. The water was over 10 feet deep in many places, more than 15 where the meandering stream bed cut through it, and almost 5 miles across at its widest, and the cover it provided had allowed them to economize significantly on manpower. The Ceridon, flowing between the southern slopes of Shadowline and Sullivan Hill to reach Thesmar Bay, came through a shallower declivity, but it also carried a lot more water than the Yareth did, and Figuera had made good use of it as well. Of the outer work's 60 miles of frontage, 20 were protected by flooded ditches and impounded water, and the Sidermarkian general had incorporated similar inundations to protect the approaches to the inner lines of entrenchments as well. The position wasn't invulnerable, no position ever truly was, but it was as strong a set of fieldworks as Hanth could have imagined. "Especially with so many guns to cover it," he thought. As long as Thesmar was in the Allies' hands and could be supplied, it was a dagger at the throat of the Imperial Desnarian Army's overland supply route out of the Grand Duchy of Silkia. Gregor Stonar and Caleb Armok might not be in a position to drive that dagger home at the moment, but that would change the instant they could find the reinforcements for the task, and they intended to keep its hilt firmly in their hands until they could. And since they didn't currently have the thousands of infantrymen they would really have preferred to send Hanth, they'd settle for the next best thing. Enough artillery to storm hell. From the moment his own force had been earmarked for Thesmar, the Imperial Carisian Navy had been throwing guns ashore and digging them in. Quite a few naval galleons were floating higher in the water than they ought to be because their artillery and artillerists were now enjoying a delightful vacation in the city the Allies meant to hold at all costs. All told, there were now 250 guns guarding Thesmar, 136 were naval 30-pounders, and 54 of the rest were stubby 57-pounder carronades, short-ranged but devastatingly powerful, and capable of extraordinarily rapid fire in the close defense role. And there were 36 of the handy, maneuverable 12-pounders as well, 2/3 of them Carisian, and the rest captured from the Dalarans. The Dalaran guns couldn't fire Carisian shells or round shot, despite their nominally identical calibers, but they could fire grape and canister just fine, and they'd been positioned primarily as flanking pieces to sweep the fronts of the entrenchments. The bastions and redoubts of General Figuera's works had been laid out by Captain Simpson and Commander Arthur Parker. Neither of them was a trained army engineer, but unlike the Sidermarkian army, the Carisian Navy had ample experience with new model artillery. They'd surveyed the position carefully before they began digging in, and they'd sighted their batteries to give as much coverage of the approaches as possible. Most of the few spots of dead ground they couldn't cover with direct fire were flooded by Figuera's inundations, and they'd already registered the angle guns on all of them they knew about.
"I won't say they can't take the position in the end if they're willing to pay the price, but I can say that they don't have a clue how high that price will be."
The thought touched him with grim satisfaction, and he raised his double glass, looking through the twin tubes at the ant-like infantry and cavalry swarming about just beyond artillery range. The double glass wasn't as powerful as the rail-mounted telescopes, but its paired eyepieces presented a three-dimensional image that gave a far greater feel for detail, and he swept it slowly across the panorama before him.
"I've never seen that many people in one place before either, Kidrick," he said after a moment. "Impressive, isn't it?" "That's one way to put it," the bald, bull-shouldered Sidermarkian replied sourly.
Despite the odds marshaled against them, Figuera seemed far more relaxed than he'd been when Hanth and his marines and seamen first arrived in Thesmar. Part of that was probably because his garrison and the limited number of civilians who hadn't yet been lifted out were actually well-fed for a change. More of it, though, undoubtedly stemmed from the knowledge that he and the men he'd managed to hold together over the terrible winter hadn't been abandoned after all. The sheer quantity of artillery and gunners the ICN had landed was proof enough of that, and the proficiency those men of his had gained with the captured Dalaran rifles Hant had handed over had done wonders for their morale and his. The Sidermarkian general had also been remarkably unfazed by the Lord Protector's insistence on putting Hant in overall command. It made sense to him, given the fact that most of the defenders' rifles, all of their artillery, and every ton of supplies had been supplied by Karras. Besides, he had even less experience with the new model weapons than their enemies did, and he knew it.
"Well," Hanth pointed out, "cavalry'll be pretty damned useless if it comes to storming entrenchments, and that's half or more of everyone we're seeing out there. And Harless is light on artillery compared to the Dalarans, according to our spies. Plus, there's the little fact that he's a Desnarian noble, and we all know how they feel about mere infantry."
The Earl shook his head, his smile reminding Figuera rather forcibly of a hungry slash lizard.
"A general who lets contempt for his adversary govern his planning is a general waiting to get his ass kicked. And I'm of the opinion that our lads have just the boots to do the kicking with."
"Do you really think he'll try an assault?"
"Not if he's got any sense, but that's where the contempt comes in. And to be fair, we should probably add inexperience to the mix."
Hanth shrugged.
"At least for the next little bit, everybody but us Carisians is operating in the complete unknown, Kidrick. I'm sure Richter and Alvarez could give Harless some pointers, and Richter is at least smart enough to try. The question is whether or not Harless is smart enough to listen. If he isn't, he and his men are going to learn the same way Alvarez and Richter did, the hard way."
"Thank you for coming so promptly, Sir Reynos." Sir Reynos Alvarez bowed just a bit stiffly to the impeccable sprig of fashion who'd greeted him as he stepped into the huge, brilliantly dyed tent. The young man in front of him couldn't have been more than 25 years old, and he was dressed in the height of style for the Imperial Desnarian court, which was one hell of a long way from the city of Thesmar. Aside from a light dress sword, he was unarmed. His dark hair was neatly curled, his hands were beautifully manicured, and Alvarez caught a whiff of expensive cologne when the youngster returned his bow.
"I am Sir Graham Keir," he said, straightening, "and I have the honor to be aide-de-camp to His Grace, the Duke of Harless."
"Of course, and this is Sir Lincoln Latimer, my own aide." Alvarez indicated the rather older, more weathered, and much tougher-looking Royal Dalaran Army captain at his side. "And Father Sullivan, my intendant."
"Honored, Father," Sir Graham murmured, bending to kiss the Shularite's ring.
He straightened again and nodded to Latimer, with the air of someone who'd essayed yet another of his social inferior's position with an expert eye. Then he turned back to Alvarez.
"If you would accompany me, Sir Reynos, His Grace is waiting."
As he followed the young exquisite down the thickly carpeted passage between walls of gently billowing cotton silk, Alvarez cudgeled his brain, trying to place Keir in the ranks of the Desnarian nobility. He wasn't having much luck when Latimer leaned closer.
"Baron Finnock, sir."
The murmur in Alvarez's ear was so faint even he could scarcely hear it.
"Third cousin of Duke Trakos and Duke Harless's grandnephew."
Alvarez nodded. Of course he was. And Talar Garman, the Duke of Trakos, happened to be Maris IV's first counselor. Sir Reynos understood the necessity of choosing men of good blood for important posts, and clearly family had to be a factor. Still, there was such a thing as attempting to find a competent man of good blood instead of one more useless court fop, even if he was family. Not that anyone should have expected anything else out of a Desnarian. They turned a corner and, finally, reached their destination. Alvarez liked his own camp comforts as much as the next man, but this monster of a tent had to measure 80 yards on a side. It must take hours to erect and strike, and it wasn't exactly something he would have associated with a hard-driving, fast-moving cavalry commander. But since all the world knew that all Desnarian officers were hard-driving, fast-moving cavalry commanders, he must be mistaken about that.
Sir Reynos Alvarez, your grace,
young Firnok murmured, bowing to a tallish, balding man with a thin, trimmed mustache and brown eyes.
Father Sullivan, his intendant, and Sir Lincoln Latmere, his aide.
He turned back to Alvarez.
Sir Alvin Garnet, his grace the Duke of Harless, he said, and went on to indicate the other three men present. Sir Marak Dinison, the Earl of Hankey, Sir Trevir Buxim, Earl of Hennet, and Father Timothy Yerdin.
Alvarez and his companions bowed in acknowledgement, and Harless waved for them to seat themselves at the magnificent inlaid table in the center of the spacious compartment. That table had to weigh 300 or 400 pounds, Alvarez estimated, and unlike the folding camp chairs he used in his own tent, the chairs around it were ornately carved and upholstered. Obviously a matched set from the same master woodcrafter who'd produced the table. Whatever Firnok's virtues as a military officer might or might not be, he was clearly an asset in a social situation. He managed to get all three of the Dalarans seated in their assigned chairs and in proper order, without as much as a single spoken word. Then he took his own seat beside his granduncle, while silent servants poured wine. Alvarez studied the others unobtrusively. Earl Hankey, he knew, was Harless's second in command. In his late 50s and very tall, he was fair-haired and brown-eyed, with a badly scarred left cheek. He was broad-shouldered, and despite the fact that he was only an earl, he was actually one of the Desnarian Empire's most powerful nobles, with a seat on the Imperial Council. Earl Hennet commanded the Army of Justice's cavalry wing, and that was enough to make anyone who'd seen new model infantry weapons in action nervous about him. He was long-limbed, but not especially tall, and while he wasn't as well-connected as Earl Hankey, he wouldn't have held the post he held without a powerful patron. In his case, that patron was Fagin McAchee, who'd become the new Duke of Colman after Divan Byrot fled to the Carizians. McAchee had arisen from relative obscurity, but he was a favorite of Bishop Executor Martin Raeslayer and related by marriage to Duke Trakos. Which means he's also related to Firnok, Alvarez thought. Wonderful.
I'm very pleased to see you, Sir Reynos, Harless said after the servants had finished pouring and departed. The victor of Alexburg must be a welcome addition to any army.
Thank you, Your Grace. Alvarez didn't quite grit his teeth, and he supposed Harless probably genuinely meant it. For that matter, Alexburg was the first Sidermarkian fortress to be stormed by a foreign enemy in the last couple of centuries. The fact that it had been blown up in his face and killed so many of his men was just one of those irritating little historical footnotes. Anyway, most of them had been commoners. Not the sort of thing a Desnarian would hold against a fellow.
And I'm also pleased to see you because your artillery train is so much more powerful than my own.
Harless waved one hand at a cotton silk wall, gesturing in the general direction of Thesmar. We're bringing up our own guns, of course, but yours would be a powerful reinforcement when we attack.
When we attack, Alvarez repeated carefully.
Of course, and as soon as possible, Harless shrugged. With the heretic navy operating so freely in the Gulf of Jaros, Tabard Reach, even Silkia Bay, we, the Empire, can move reinforcements only overland. Oh, our batteries are enough to protect Silk Town and keep the Silk Town Thesmar Canal open, but, he grimaced distastefully, after our navy's regrettable defeat at Eithria, we can't be certain how long that will be true. I'm assured the situation's currently secure, but even with the canal we can move no farther north than Lake Somir by water, and as long as Thesmar remains in heretic hands, the possibility that they'll suddenly reinforce and move against our supply lines can't be ignored.
For that matter, it would remain a serious threat to your own supply lines down the Ceridon as we continue our advance toward Shiloh. At the moment, however, our spies and the local faithful report there are no more than 10,000 to 15,000 men in the city. He shrugged again. The obvious solution is to crush it now, before its garrison can be further strengthened. Alvarez sat very still, wishing suddenly that Sir Foster Richter were present. He wasn't especially fond of his own second-in-command, although he was honest enough to admit, at least to himself, that the main reason he wasn't was that he'd ignored Richter's advice when he diverted his own advance to Alexburg instead of trying to crush Thesmar when it truly was weak. Given the many 5 days his own unwise diversion had allowed the heretic Figuera and his garrison to change that state of affairs, he rather doubted the city could be crushed remotely as easily as Harless seemed to assume, not that he had any desire to explain the reasons for that to the Desnarians. And, he admitted, he found himself wondering if Harless had omitted to invite Richter because he'd wanted to get Alvarez by himself and overwhelm any resistance to assaulting the heretics before he could discuss it with his own officers. His instructions from King Ronald and Mother Church were clear. As the commander of 70% of the combined Dalaran and Desnarian field strength in the South March, Harless was the Jihad's senior officer present. Much as it galled Alvarez, he'd been instructed to accept Harless's directions. Even the Inquisition hadn't wanted to call them orders for the prosecution of the campaign. On the other hand, it had been made quietly and privately clear to him by the Duke of Southar, the commander of the Royal Dalaran Army, that he was not supposed to simply hand over command to the Desnarians. But Father Sullivan was remarkably silent on that point, wasn't he? Mother Church is the one behind this sword-point marriage with Desnare. And what do you do if he tells you to shut up and take Harless's orders anyway? I agree that Thesmar represents a serious potential threat to our lines of communication, Your Grace, he said after a moment. And the possibility that the heretics will find the men to turn it into an actual threat can't be ignored. Unfortunately, the heretic navy's been landing artillery for 5 days now. I've only just arrived myself, so I've had no opportunity to personally reconnoitre the enemy's position, but I'm very much afraid our 12-pounders are no match for heavy naval artillery, especially not naval artillery that's been thoroughly dug in behind solid earthworks. I realize your guns, like our own, are lighter than naval guns. There might have been just a hint of frost in Harless's courteous tone. There are, however, some advantages to that, and I understand you also have your own version of the artillery the heretics employed against our fortresses at Eithria. His expression made the sentence a question, and Alvarez felt his lips tighten. It was true that his artillery train included several batteries of what the heretics had dubbed angle guns. They were much smaller than the heretical version, firing the same shells as his field guns, and he suspected they were also shorter-ranged. What irked him the most about them, however, was the reason he had them, for they'd been the brainchildren of Lewis Gardiner, the Earl of Thirsk, and there was no love lost between him and Thirsk. At the moment, though... Yes, Your Grace, we do have some angle guns. Their shells are no heavier than those of our field pieces, however, and frankly we don't have many of them. I'd have to check to be certain, but I believe we have no more than 4 or 5 batteries. A heavier version, firing much larger shells, is in production, and will probably reach us within the next month or two. But for now, I seriously doubt the weapons we possess would be enough to breach the heretics' lines. I wouldn't expect them to, Sir Renos, Harless said. Nor am I suggesting we should attempt to blast a breach through the heretics' earthworks as if they were the stone walls of a castle. No. I have something rather different in mind. Different in what way, if I may ask? So far, no heretic's ever been fired upon using the... angle guns, did you call them? The Duke raised an eyebrow, and Alvarez nodded. As I say, they've used the weapons against God's loyal sons, but they've never been on the receiving end of them. I realize you've had no chance yet to personally observe the heretic's positions, and I'll value your opinion once you've had that opportunity.
From my own observation, however, the heretic left appears vulnerable. They've covered the low ground by flooding it, but they can't flood the high ground. I propose, assuming you concur, of course, to assault across Sullivan Hill, thus avoiding the flooded ground. My scouts report two redoubts atop the hill, each with a half dozen or so heavy guns. But heavy guns are slow firing, Sir Reynos. Much slower than our own field guns, at any rate, and I feel sure your angle guns can fire more rapidly than they as well. We have many fewer cannon, but their guns are dispersed throughout their defences, while ours can be concentrated in one place, and ours are light enough to be quickly and quietly moved into position. So my intention is to bring them up under cover of darkness and deploy them in a massed battery to sweep the heretics' parapets with shot and shell. We'll open fire just at dawn, when they have no cause to expect it, and use your angle guns to drop fire directly on their heads at the same time. The surprise of such a sudden bombardment, and of receiving the fire of someone else's angle guns, is bound to dismay them, and their positions can't possibly be heavily manned, not with the length of their works and the small size of the garrison. Surprised, frightened, and outnumbered, they'll be no match for God's true sons when our assault columns go in with cold steel. The Desnarian's arrogantly confident expression sent a stab of dismay through Sir Reynos Alvarez. Worse, Sullivan Fairman was nodding, eyes fierce with his burning desire to strike the heresy in the heart, and that was a bad sign. By and large, Alvarez was of one mind with his intendant, and the only thing he was prepared to waste on a heretic was the powder to blow him to hell. But Fearman's passionate devotion could lead him into enthusiasms which sometimes overlooked practical objections. "And Father Timothy's another chip off the same block," he thought, glancing at the Desnarian intendant. "As soon as the two of them get their heads together, they'll want us in Thesmar yesterday, and I can't blame them for that either. It's what they ought to want, what I ought to want, and I do." He wondered what really made him hesitate to embrace Harless's plan, or idea, at least. It would probably be unfair to call it a plan at this point, and he had no business rejecting it until he'd actually examined the possibilities. Was what had happened when he rushed in at Alexburg against another hugely outnumbered garrison affecting him now? "You can't allow the way one batch of heretics tricked you once to deflect you from your duty," he told himself sternly. "And while you're thinking about having been tricked, you might want to remember that the coward who left his men to die to set that trap is inside Thesmar with the rest of the heretics. Don't pretend you don't want to drag him out of his burrow." "It sounds like an audacious plan, Your Grace," he said finally. "Until I've actually seen the ground and the heretics' fortifications, I can't form an opinion about its practicality, and I'd like to get some of my own artillerist's views on it as well. I'd prefer to say neither yes or no until I've had the opportunity to do those things, but you're quite right about how badly outnumbered they are, and it's true they've never taken fire from angle guns themselves. Perhaps it's time we corrected that minor fact." Chapter 9. Gorath, Kingdom of Dolar.
"So, Lieutenant, what do you have for us today?" the Earl of Thirsk inquired as he walked into Lieutenant Dennis Zweiger's workshop, accompanied by Bishop Stefan Mike and followed by Commander Alvin Kapar. The workshop was well lit, if scarcely luxurious. Thirsk had commandeered the ground floor of a dockside warehouse for Zweiger's work, and if its appointments were on the Spartan side, it had several other recommendations. For one thing, it was actually inside the Royal Dalaran Navy's largest dockyard, conveniently placed for Thirsk as that navy's commander to visit at need. It was also conveniently placed for Zweiger to supervise the 6 armored screw galleys being hastily built under his direction in that same dockyard. And because it was inside the dockyard's perimeter, it was also easily guarded. Truth be told, that consideration was the most important of all, Thirsk thought sourly.
It was vital to keep any Carisian spies from figuring out what Jouéguer was up to, and equally important to keep any fanatic temple loyalists from figuring out the same thing. Jouéguer's explorations were sanctioned by Mother Church in the person of Bishop Stifon and a specific writ of attestation from Father Absalon Karmic, Gorath's intendant. Not perhaps happily in Father Absalon's case, he was an old-school Schulerite who'd never been happy with the need to adapt to the heretic's new weapons, but sanctioned nonetheless. That wouldn't prevent someone among the more ardent against the reformist heresy and the blasphemous Carisian advances from taking it into his head to murder the lieutenant and burn his workshop to the ground before it could further poison the spiritual health of Dolar.
Which is also the reason Alvin and I put so much thought into picking the marines assigned to guard the place, the Earl reminded himself more than a little bitterly as Jouéguer turned from the long work table and came to attention. Shanwei's sides must ache from laughter when I have to worry about whether or not my own marines will be so ardent they decide to kill one of the men the jihad most needs. And isn't it interesting that Karmic signed the writ, not Clintan? I have to wonder if the Grand Inquisitor's keeping the hem of his cassock clear so no one can accuse him of having been hypocritical when he decides he doesn't need young Dinis anymore and has him eliminated. If not for the fact that Clintan clearly didn't worry his head over charges of hypocrisy, Thirsk would have been certain that was why the attestation had come from Karmic. As it was, he couldn't quite decide it wasn't his paranoia speaking. Of course, even a paranoiac can really have enemies, can't he? My lord, the very tall, fair-haired lieutenant greeted the Earl. My lord Bishop. He bowed respectfully to Mike before bending to kiss the cleric's ring, then saluted Kapar.
Good morning, my son,
Mike smiled. The bishop was in his 50s, with a weakness for sweetbreads, which accounted for the increased thickening of his midsection. And despite the fact that he was a Schulerite in the middle of a jihad, he was also a warm-hearted and cheerful man.
I see you've been busy.
I have, my lord. Jouéguer stepped back, waving at the work table, and Thirsk realized it was actually four very large tables which had been pushed together to make a single enormous platform. He stepped up to it with the bishop, and his eyebrows rose as he looked at the pieces heaped in neatly segregated stacks on its surface. It looked as if someone had completely disassembled four of the heretic's breech-loading rifles.
Was it really necessary to take four of them apart to figure out how one of them worked, Lieutenant?
He asked a bit whimsically. Not to figure out how they worked, my lord, but I did learn quite a few other interesting things about them in the process. Thirsk nodded. He'd hoped that would be the case, and he'd lobbied hard to have the captured heretical weapons Vicar Elaine had sent to Dolar handed over to Jouéguer. Shane Howell, the Duke of Southar, had been disinclined to grant the request for several reasons. One was the hostility of Thirsk's enemies within the Royal Dolaran army, which became only more pronounced every time it turned out he'd been right and they'd been wrong. But the Earl suspected that was secondary in this instance. It was more likely that Southar, a reasonably intelligent fellow, if getting on in years, but still wedded to old-style army tactics, simply hadn't grasped how critical it was for Dolar to find a way to match the Carisians' capabilities. He'd seen no reason for anyone to fiddle around with dangerous, heretical, potentially proscribed devices when the last thing anyone wanted was to bring the fury of Shuler or Zhuojiang down on the kingdom of Dolar for apostasy. In the end, it had taken a direct order from Father Absalon to change his mind, and even that had been issued only after Bishop Stifon had pestered the intendant for more than a 5-day.
What sort of interesting things?
The Earl asked now.
Allow me to demonstrate, if you will, my lord.
Of course.
Then if you and Bishop Stifon will stand to one side, it would never do to get either of you oily. I'll ask Alvin to assist me. I doubt Pierre would be too furious at having to clean a little oil out of my tunic,
Thirsk observed, but he also smiled and obeyed the polite command. He found a workbench whose surface was more or less clear and hitched himself up to sit on it. He was short enough his toes didn't quite touch the floor,
but he was used to that. The sunlight pouring in through the windows behind him illuminated the piles of rifle parts, and he folded his arms to wait patiently.
"Now, Alvin," Schweiger said, "these piles," he waved at the disassembled rifles, "are arranged in the order I'm going to need. What I want you to do is pick a piece at random from each pile when I ask for it. Clear?"
"Clear,"
Kapar agreed. "Then let's get started. If you'd hand me a lock plate, please."
The commander poked around in the indicated stack for a moment, then selected a lock plate and passed it across. Schweiger took it, laid it on the tabletop, and pointed at the next stack.
"I need a cock now."
Thirsk and Mike watched as Kapar selected a part from each pile, handing each in turn to Schweiger until the taller lieutenant had all the bits and pieces, including the stock, for one of the Carizian rifles laid out in front of him. Then Schweiger opened his toolbox and went to work. His nimble, dexterous fingers moved as confidently as if he'd manufactured all the parts himself. And Thirsk was fascinated as he watched the weapon come together. It took a remarkably brief period for Schweiger to complete the task. Then he turned from the tabletop, holding the rifle in his hands.
"And now, my lord, would you do the honors?"
He passed the weapon to Thirsk, who slid off the workbench to take it and stood looking quizzically back at him.
"Obviously it's unloaded, my lord, but would you do me the favor of dry-firing it?"
Thirsk gazed at him a moment longer, then shrugged. He'd seen one of the rifles demonstrated the day they were delivered to Schweiger, and he turned the lever that dropped the square, massive breech block down and back through the guides. It moved smoothly, and he raised the rifle high enough to peer into the open breech and make certain it was truly unloaded. He closed the breech again, giving the lever a small extra pull to be sure it was seated properly, then cocked the hammer. It came back smoothly, clicking as it locked in the fully cocked position, and he raised the rifle to his shoulder, making certain the muzzle was pointed in a safe direction, and squeezed the trigger. There was more slack in the trigger than in any of his hunting weapons, but that was to be expected, since each of those rifles was the work of Handil Metziger, a master gunsmith who specialized in sporting weapons for the wealthy. A Metziger firearm had been an individual work of art, beautiful to behold, even before the heretics introduced the flintlock to safe hold, and the actions on his flintlocks were as much precision instruments as any chronometer. Despite the long pull, the breech loader's trigger broke surprisingly cleanly and crisply, however, and the hammer snapped down on the nipple which should have worn one of the heretic's priming caps. He lowered the rifle and turned back to Schweiger, both eyebrows raised.
"It functioned properly and smoothly, my lord," the lieutenant said.
"Of course it did, lieutenant,"
Thirsk cocked his head.
"I know you well enough by now to realize you really do have a point, but could we get to the part where you make it?"
"Of course, my lord. My point is that the rifle in your hands was assembled from randomly chosen parts. I simply took the ones Alvin picked out and put them together, without a single bit of adjustment or filing to fit."
"And?"
Thirsk felt comprehension hovering just beyond his grasp as he handed the rifle to Kapar.
"And no gunsmith in the world could do that with one of our army's rifles, my lord," Schweiger said flatly. "It's impossible. Our rifles are built in individual shops by journeymen and apprentices overseen by master gunsmiths. It might be possible to interchange parts between rifles made in the same shop by the same workers, but even that would be extremely unlikely. The parts in all of these rifles, all of them, my lord, are effectively identical. I've measured them very carefully and found some extremely small variations in size, but none of them are significant. And the heretics were kind enough to stamp each of these rifles, and the parts that go into it, with a number code. I'm not certain why they did that, but looking at the sequence of numbers and the proof marks, I can tell you this particular group of rifles didn't just happen to come from the same master gunsmith and his assistants, not unless they skipped ahead several hundred numbers between individual weapons at any rate."
"Shanwei,"
Alvin Kapar murmured, and whether it was a curse or an explanation was more than Thirsk could have said. The Earl looked at the bishop and saw the same consternation on Mike's face. Then he returned his attention to Joyeguerre.
"Your family's been involved in the iron trade for a long time, Dennis," he said, abandoning formality in the face of the lieutenant's revelations. "Do you have any idea how they manage this?"
"Short of direct demonic intervention, you mean, my son?" Mike asked dryly. From another Schulerite, the question would have been deadly serious, but Thirsk's special intendant smiled crookedly when the Earl glanced quickly at him.
"I think we can assume this is the product of mortal men," he continued, "although I have no more idea of how it was done than you do, Lewis."
"Neither do I, my lord," Joyeguerre admitted. "Oh, I can see some ways to approach the problem, but not on the scale the heretics obviously have. My uncle uses jigs. Those are devices designed to lock a piece into place in such a fashion that it can be filed or smoothed or cut in only one way, to manufacture small parts, but his jigs are individually designed and built. No one else would have had the same jigs and fixtures, so parts produced in one manufactory wouldn't fit with parts produced in another manufactory, the way the heretics have accomplished here. And judging from the tool marks on some of these pieces, parts that would have been forged and filed in any manufactory I'm familiar with seem to have been stamped instead. That indicates that the heretics are using a lot more powered machinery like trip hammers and stamp mills than we are. And if I'm right about what they're doing, none of the people actually producing these parts and putting them together are likely to be members of the Gunsmith Guild, far less master gunsmiths. Given some time to think about it, my uncle could probably set up a shop to do a lot of the same things, but he has no more than 100 workmen. I can't even begin to estimate what his output might be if he followed the heretics' example with powered machinery, but I can't believe it would be anywhere near what the heretics have actually accomplished. They must have scores of manufactories that size producing these things, and that brings us right back to how that many different manufactories can produce parts which are interchangeable with parts from all the other manufactories. If nothing else, they'd all have to agree to use the same inches and feet, and then figure out how to do it."
Thirsk looked at Mike, and the bishop shrugged. Mother Church had already signed off on more innovations in the last 3 years than in the last 3 centuries. It was possible Jaspar Clinton might go so far as to permit the sort of changes Joyeguerre was describing. It was also possible he wouldn't.
"I understand what you're saying, or I think I do at least," the Earl said after a moment. "But surely we have far more gunsmiths in all of the realms loyal to Mother Church than the heretics do in Caris. Even granting that our rate of production will be lower, isn't it possible our total production could still be higher than theirs?"
"I can't say, my lord," Joyeguerre replied honestly.
"I'm inclined to think it probably could, as long as we stick to our existing rifle design rather than try to duplicate this one."
"I beg your pardon?"
"My lord, many of the parts in this rifle, and especially the breech block and receiver, are clearly machined using powered tools we don't have. Craftsmen like my uncle could probably create those tools, but first we'd have to design them, then build them, then get them distributed, and in the meantime we'd be producing none of these weapons. I'd also guess, and it's only a guess at this point, my lord, that for each rifle of this type we built using our existing system of gunsmiths, we could build as many as 10 or 15 of our present muzzle-loading rifles. That means each of them would cost 10 or 15 times as much, which I suspect would be a sufficiently serious problem by itself. But it also means we could arm only 1/10 or 1/15 as many of our men with them, and that assumes my off-the-cuff guess is accurate. Not only that, but all of the metal parts in this rifle are steel, not iron. Our rifles use steel only for high-stress parts like springs, trigger guards, and things like that. We use iron barrels and lock plates, and we use brass in many of the low-stress parts because steel is so expensive. I don't see any reason why the heretics couldn't have done the same thing, but they didn't. And that suggests to me, my lord bishop, that their steel production must be far, far in excess of our own, of anything anyone ever imagined before. And I can also tell you, having worn down a brand new file testing it, that it's much better steel, much harder and tougher than anything I've ever seen before."
Joyeguerre shook his head, his normally calm expression almost frightened. Long before the Jihad, Caris was called
iron master to the world for good reason, my lord. Carisian foundries produced more and better iron, wrought iron and blackheart iron than anyone else. But not in the quantities this, he tapped the steel barrel of the assembled rifle, seems to imply.
I see.
Thirsk glanced at Mike again, seeing an echo of his own bitter reflections in the bishop's eyes. Zweigair was doing exactly what they needed him to do if Mother Church was to win the jihad, yet if he expressed himself this frankly, even in a written report to Jaspar Clinton and the Inquisition, the consequences for him could well be catastrophic.
But it's not his responsibility to be making those reports, is it? The Earl asked himself. You're his commanding officer. You're the one who put him in this workshop to draw those conclusions, the one who's responsible for making someone, anyone, listen to you when you tell them the simple truth, and for dealing with the consequences of what happens when you do.
He glanced at Kapar from the corner of his eye, and the man who would have been called his chief of staff back on a planet named Terra returned his gaze calmly. Thirsk had hated involving Kapar, but he'd discovered he couldn't do it alone, and there were very few men he could trust to help with what had become the most important task in his life.
It would help if I could tell the girls what Alvin's up to, but I can't do that either. I don't think any of them would balk if I could find a way to get them out of the Inquisition's protective custody, but I can't be certain of that. And then there are their husbands. And the minor fact that if I breathed a hint of any such thought to anyone, and it got back to Karmic or the Inquisition, we'd all be dead.
He still didn't know what he'd do if he could get his daughters out of Gorath to some place where the Inquisition couldn't make examples out of his family. Surely Mother Church and his kingdom had first claim on his loyalty. How could he even imagine rejecting that claim? But if the only way to win the jihad, to preserve Mother Church and his kingdom, required him to do things for which he would stand condemned in the eyes of the Grand Inquisitor, did he truly have any choice but to reject that claim in the name of a greater loyalty? He had no answer for that question even now, and he put it aside yet again and looked down at the assembled rifle once more.
The reports from Sir Reynos and General Richter all emphasize the advantages breech-loading gives the heretics, Dinis. I hate to say it, but perhaps we have no choice but to accept that we can produce far fewer rifles in order to give the troops we do field the weapons they need to survive in battle. And if iron serves well enough for the barrels of our current muzzle-loading rifles, then it will just have to serve for the breech-loading ones we need as well.
I've been thinking about that too, my lord, Zweigair told him, and I'm not sure this is the only or even the best way to close a rifle's breech.
You're not?
Thirst's question came out sounding more like a statement, and Zweigair shook his head.
I'm not sure my idea's practical. I think it is, and I'd like your permission to discuss it with my uncle and some of his artisans, but it occurs to me that it might be possible to simply drill a vertical hole through the barrel and thread it. If the pitch of the threads was properly planned and cut, we could screw a plug through the holes that would seal the breech even better than the heretic's design does, and without that felt pad they use. The metal-to-metal seal should be gas-tight if we get the design right.
Thirsk blinked, then looked quickly back at Mike.
That sounds like a very interesting idea, my son, the bishop said, and Thirsk heard the additional message buried in Mike's tone.
Not only was the idea interesting, but Thirsk couldn't see a single aspect of it that could possibly rouse the Inquisition's ire against Zweigair.
Don't get too optimistic about that, Lewis, he told himself after a moment. God only knows what could rouse the Inquisition's ire these days. As the situation gets worse, the worst of the Inquisitors only get more fanatical.
This would be faster than simply duplicating the heretic's design.
It would certainly be faster unless we could duplicate whatever powered machinery they're using as well, my lord.
Zweigair shrugged.
We could get it into production more quickly because we'd have to change very little about the existing rifles, although I doubt it would be as simple as converting the ones we've already built.
And I'd guess that once we do have it into production, we could build a rifle to this design at a rate of, say, one for every four of the existing rifles. It would still represent a huge drop in production rate, but nowhere near as much of a drop as duplicating this design would. He tapped the barrel of the assembled rifle again, and Thirsk nodded.
And what about these primer caps of theirs?
My lord, my experience is with iron, steel, and brass. Not the mysteries of Bedard and Pasquale. But I'm reasonably certain that what they've done is to take a tiny drop of fulminated mercury and seal it inside the cap, probably with a drop of varnish. When the hammer falls, the fulminated mercury detonates and flashes over to ignite the cartridge.
I see.
Thirsk's eyes met Mike's once again. From what Jouéguer was saying, duplicating the Heretic's primer caps wouldn't be insuperably difficult from a manufacturing perspective. From every other perspective, it would mean a direct confrontation with the teachings of Schuller and Pasquale, however, and it was anyone's guess whether or not Jaspar Clinton would grant yet another dispensation of such magnitude.
The advantage these give the heretics is pronounced, my lord, he said quietly to the bishop. We have more misfires than they do, even in clear weather. In the rain, they fire just as reliably as they do in sunshine, and our men can't.
I understand that, Lewis. Mike's expression was troubled, even worried.
And I agree. But, my son, this is one suggestion you must let come from someone else. I know you're already going to be making quite a few based on the lieutenant's work. Pick the ones you make carefully. Don't waste your influence on less important ones, or ones that someone else can make just as well.
Influence, indeed, Thirsk thought dryly. You mean don't use up any more of the limited patience my superiors and Mother Church have where my nagging is concerned.
You're probably right about that.
His tone acknowledged what the bishop had truly said, and he turned back to Jouéguer.
You've done just as well with this task as I've come to expect of you, Lieutenant, he said,
the words formal, but the tone warm.
Be good enough to write it up for me in a proper report, and I'll see what I can do about getting it into the hands of the people who need to see it.
And we'll just have to hope they read it after I do, he added silently.
Of course, my lord.
Good. Thirsk patted him on the shoulder, then gathered up Kapar with his eyes.
Alvin, you and I, and the bishop, are already late for my meeting with Admiral Turner. I think we'd better be going.
Chapter 10 HMS Destiny, 56, and Royal Palace, City of Monchir, Princedom of Coruscant. The Carizian galleon made her way majestically from the broad waters of Whitehorse Reach into Monchir Bay. Despite the lengthy voyage from Chisholm, her black hull with the single white strake of her main deck gun ports was immaculate. And while an admiral's streamer flew at her foremast, another flag flew from her mainmast's lofty head. Its blue field showed a silver crown, and it bore a black canton embroidered with crossed swords in orange. It was not a Carizian flag, for all that it flew in the place of greatest honor, and on this day, flying that banner in this place, the name picked out in gold leaf across that galleon's stern, HMS Destiny, seemed somehow more appropriate than ever before. Her escorting squadron accompanied her watchfully, keeping a wary eye on the blizzard of small craft which had put out to meet her. Monchir Bay was over 130 miles deep, north to south, and almost as wide, and some of those craft were small enough to be perilously far from land. Fortunately, the morning's weather was magnificent, with a tropical sky like a burnished blue dome, a scatter of blinding white clouds, and a stiff, topgallant breeze, what would have been called a force 4 wind on the ancient Beaufort scale, following her into the bay from the southeast. The wind raised waves about 4 feet tall and pushed her along at a steady 7 knots. White water creamed about her bows, and her wake trailed behind her, a fading carpet of smoothed green water over which raucous clouds of greedy gulls and wyverns swept and darted.
The sun was hot even this early, as it usually was less than 700 miles below the equator, for all that it was winter in Safehold's southern hemisphere, and the northeast shore of Montier Bay was a dark green blur from the galleon's deck. Princess Iris Dakin stood on that deck as she had since shortly after dawn, hazel eyes bright as she gazed at that green blur, the blur of the Duchy of Montier, the blur of her homeland, of the coastal hills, coarse, blowing grass, and the circling bird wings of the land where she'd been born for the first time in nearly 3 years. She was almost 3 months short of 20, and that was more than young enough for 3 years to have seemed an eternity under any circumstances. Under the circumstances which obtained, they had been an eternity. There'd been times, more than she could count, when she'd known she would never be allowed to see Coruscant again. And there'd been even darker times when she'd known she and her baby brother would not be permitted to live even in exile. Yet here she was, the wind blowing her dark hair in a silken cloud, and the heart hunger rising in her throat like an exquisite pain. A 20-foot cutter dared the watchful cordon of Destiny's escorts, darting towards the galleon in a flurry of white water and heeling canvas, her lee rails buried as she slid exuberantly across the waves in rainbow clouds of flying spray, a long orange and white streamer blowing starch stiff at her masthead.
"Princess Iris! Princess Iris!"
she heard the shout through the sounds of sea and wave, saw someone standing beside the mast. The other woman clung to it for balance, waving the orange and white scarf in her free hand wildly above her head as she recognized the slim, straight figure on the foreign warship's deck.
"God bless you, Princess Iris! Welcome home! Oh, welcome home!"
Iris's throat closed, and she waved back to the cutter, wondering who that woman was, why she'd come so far out to sea to greet them in so small a craft. HMS Seahorse, one of the escorts, altered course slightly, bearing down on the cutter. It was obvious her captain had no intention of actually running down the far smaller boat, but her message was clear, and the cutter bore obediently away. Iris heard her name floating back from it one more time, and then Seahorse resumed her original course, and she heard someone chuckle softly beside her. She turned her head, expecting to see her chaperone, the Countess of Hanth. Lady Myra really should have been with her, given all the commonly born seamen jammed into Destiny's hull and the countless ways in which they might have offended against Iris's birth and lineage. That was the way the no-doubt scandalized nobles of her father's court would have seen it, at any rate. After so long aboard this galleon, though, Iris Dakin knew there wasn't a man aboard it who would not have died to protect her, and she'd been contaminated enough by her contact with Karis and Carizians to recognize and treasure their cheery greetings and nods of welcome. Lady Myra might have been born Chisomian, but she, too, had come to understand Carizian ways, and that was why she'd only nodded and gone right on listening to her stepson Truman's reading lesson when Iris announced she was going on deck for some fresh air. She'd known the real reason Iris wanted to be on that deck, watching that land come closer and closer, of course. Lady Myra always seemed to know by instinct when what Iris really needed was privacy and time to think, and she'd always tried to let the princess in her charge have that privacy. It wasn't easy on a ship, even one as large as Destiny, but she tried. Iris opened her mouth to thank the Countess for her consideration, then paused as she found herself looking into Hector Aplin Armok's brown eyes instead. He stood at her shoulder, and she wondered how long he'd been there. In a way, she'd been surprised when he hadn't joined her on deck immediately after breakfast, but then she'd realized he, too, was deliberately giving her space and time. It was like him to realize she'd needed that privacy, but now she was glad he was here, and she reached out to take his hand.
"I understand why the Admiral wants to make sure no one gets too close alongside before we've got you and Diven safely ashore," Hector said. We've seen what wagon loads of gunpowder can do in city streets. God only knows what a ton or two blowing up close aboard a galleon would do. But I have to say, looking at how many sails are bobbing around out there, that you must be a pretty popular lady. He screwed his face up in a thoughtful expression and nodded wisely. Of course, I think I'd heard something to that effect before. You don't want to believe everything you hear, though.
Oh, you don't you?
She punched him on the shoulder with her free hand. Well, rumors can be deceptive, you know.
Yes, I do.
She agreed in a softer voice, eyes darkening briefly as she recalled the rumors about who'd actually paid for her father's murder. But that was an old pain now, one she'd learned to deal with, and she banished it quickly.
For example, she continued, I've heard rumors that you're, emotionally involved with someone.
Odd. He looked at her with a puzzled expression.
I've heard the same rumors about you. Oh, I'm certain you're mistaken, Lieutenant Aplin Armark, she said demurely. That would scarcely be ladylike.
No, it wouldn't, would it? He murmured, and Iris felt a gentle heat across the high cheekbones she'd inherited from her mother as she remembered the handful of moments alone and unsupervised the two of them had managed to seize in Chiraeth. Opportunities had been fewer and much farther between aboard Destiny, given the galleon's crowded state, but they'd been more than enough to banish any fear that theirs would be a bloodless, passionless marriage of state.
In that case, there couldn't possibly be any truth to the rumors, she told him just a bit snippily. For I, Lieutenant, am always a lady.
That's what my stepmother said upon occasion, too, Hector observed.
And she sticks her nose up in the air just like that when she does it.
I never really believed her, though. About the always bit, I mean.
I believe she and I did discuss something about sailors and reunions after long voyages. Not that I have any personal experience of the matter, of course.
Oh, of course not. They smiled at one another, then turned to look back over the galleon's rail at the land slipping slowly past.
At this rate, we'll make port sometime in the late afternoon, he told her.
Nervous?
Oh, no. Why should I possibly be nervous?
I can't imagine, he said innocently, and moved his elbow as if by instinct to block the jab she aimed at his rib cage. What about diving? He asked in a rather more serious tone, and she sighed.
Sometimes I think he still doesn't really grasp what's going on at all. Other times I'm sure he does, and he's just pretending, maybe to himself, even more than me, that he doesn't. And still other times, he discusses it with me with this incredibly serious expression. I see a little bit of father in his eyes when that happens.
Really? He looked down at her, and she shook her head.
Not the ambition, Hector. It's the understanding, I guess. The look father got when his brain was fully engaged. He really was a very smart man, you know. Not in all ways. Or maybe what I mean is that he was smart without always being wise. But he really did care about the well-being of Coruscant. Sometimes what he wanted, what he thought would be best for Coruscant and what he went about giving it, wasn't really what his people needed or what they wanted. But I think he genuinely convinced himself that his ambitions were truly their ambitions as well. I don't think he ever really realized they supported his efforts to expand his power because they supported him, not because they wanted anything of the sort themselves. And I've come to think any ruler has to be careful about assuming that the people he actually sees and talks to, the nobles on his council, his diplomats and generals and admirals, really understand or care about what's best for his entire realm. It's awfully easy to get trapped inside a bubble like that and ignore anyone outside it, Hector. I've seen it, and now I recognize the danger. And smart as he was, I don't think he ever did. He played the game by the rules he knew and never bothered to learn another set.
Her tone was somber, her expression sad, and she gazed at that welcoming green blur for several seconds before she looked back up at Hector again.
But flawed as he might have been, he truly did care.
And if Divan does have some of that same concern inside, hiding under the prince, learning to be a little boy again, then with a little direction and a little guidance, maybe.
Her voice trailed off, and Hector nodded. I'll take your word about your father. Iris's heart warmed as she heard the simple sincerity in his voice. How many men whose king had died in their arms could genuinely have believed the prince responsible for that death had sought to be the best ruler he knew how to be, however poorly he'd truly understood the job in the end? But what I've seen of Divan so far is pretty hopeful. He's a good kid, Iris, and one of these days, if we can just keep him from being poisoned by toadies and court politics, I think he's going to be a pretty good man, too. Iris suppressed a chill as she thought about all the ways toadies and court politics could poison the mind and soul of so youthful a prince. Divan had celebrated his 11th birthday only 10 days earlier, right here on Destiny, and God knew he truly was a baby to be inheriting a throne. That would have been true at any time, far less in times as chaotic as these, and Iris knew enough about courts and the maneuvering which went on within them to feel that cold bite of fear. It was so easy for a child to be shaped for good or ill by the adults around him, and especially when that child was a prince. There would always be those who would be prepared to play the sycophant or the betrayer, and the cataclysm of the war racking Safehold would offer far too many openings for opportunistic scum.
"Well, we'll just have to keep that from happening, won't we?"
she asked herself tartly.
"And he could have worse influences than Hector come to that. But how do we stand guard against that kind of poison without making it obvious we're doing it? Without making him think we don't trust him to protect himself against it? And what happens when a teenage Divan starts to fret about all the people who won't let him do what he wants? When other people tell him he can do what he wants, whatever he wants, starts promising him the sun and the moon and the stars?"
She thought about her older brother, wondering, not for the first time, how much of his petulance and spoiled refusal to understand the responsibilities which came with the privileges of birth had been the work of people just like that. She'd never know about that, for no one had ever attempted to mold her to their purposes. She liked to think that was because they'd known they'd fail, but deep inside she had to admit what she'd always known. There'd been little point in any court faction's attempting to bend her to its purposes, for she'd been only a daughter. Why waste effort on her when the future prince himself had been so accessible and ready to hand? And if Divan had been too young to be included in their plans before their father sent them to Delphirac, that was no longer the case, was it? What would happen when... She shook herself and inhaled deeply, nostrils flaring as the salt air filled her lungs, and told herself sternly to let tomorrow take care of itself. The writ told God's children to do the best they could each day and trust him and the archangels to look after them when tomorrow came. Princes and princesses and emperors and empresses were less free to do that than most of his children, for the weight of a crown was heavy. But there were times when even they simply had to stand back and trust him to get it right.